that terrorism charge, the first judge, after a very perfunctory hearing, declared that the petitioner was a terrorist and a threat to national security, and without any further testimony, declared that he was removable as charged. The appeal came up, and the board found that that was lacking and sent it back down for additional hearings, where the petitioner used consistent testimony that he actually never was involved in the Khalistan commando force, and that his involvement was only with a student organization and the Akali Dal organization. The terrorism charge is significant, as pointed out in petitioner's 28J motion, that this is an issue that is troublesome. Obviously, we have concerns for national security, but we don't want to tarnish people that aren't deserved of such tarnishment for terrorism charges. The second point I'd like to make is for the inconsistencies. One immigration judge finds in the administrative...
What is the evidence that he would be subjected to persecution if he went back to India?
Your Honor, the testimony, it would be the petitioner's testimony.
That's not very credible. Isn't there some objective evidence concerning the status of Sikhs in India?
There is country reports that talks about the Sikhs had difficulties in the early 90s, and then it sort of...
After the assassination of Indira Gandhi, but that's a long time ago.
But there's still some low level of...
Yeah, some low level. I don't think that amounts to persecution.
That may be so, Your Honor.
Then he loses.
I'm sorry?
Then he loses. If he has no well-founded fear of persecution, that's the end.
Well, that may be the end for his asylum claim, if that is the case. But to bring it back to the terrorism charge...
Well, what's left? I don't understand. That's what he wants. He wants asylum. He can't get it if he has no well-founded fear of persecution.
Your Honor, one of the additional issues as his time in the United States continued is he's now married to a United States citizen. If this terrorism charge sticks, then he will never be able to return to the United States. And that's why his concern of the terrorism charge is such, because then his wife will never be able to see him again in this country. And, Your Honor, the additional inconsistencies by the judge. The first judge finds that he had met the one-year rule. The second judge says no, he did not.
So if you don't have a good asylum claim, can you just challenge a finding? I don't understand. I've never seen that before.
Your Honor, I'm not sure of the legal stance of finding that terrorism charge in this court. I'd be happy to submit additional briefing on that issue if you would like.
When does the clock start to run on the 1 year when somebody comes into the country surreptitiously?
Well, that's one of the difficulties in asylum. If you come in surreptitiously, because the legal standard is clear and convincing evidence, essentially, in my experience, it's virtually impossible to prove that one-year rule, and so you're left to the exceptions to the one-year rule to show your entry and eligibility for asylum. So I guess it would be just...
So the only way you can get in is by changed circumstances. Huh?
Correct, because if you come in surreptitiously, the only way would be through testimony. And I don't believe I've seen a court case where the one-year rule has been met by testimony alone, and that's all that a surreptitious enter has. One last point here on the inconsistencies and mischaracterizations. The second judge continues to go over what she refers to as his detailed statement, which, you know, is only one or two sentences. Initial affidavits in asylum claims are frequently lacking to be further developed in testimony. And that testimony, the first time that that petitioner had a chance to develop, was in front of the second immigration judge because of the first immigration judge's perfunctory hearing just solely on that terrorism charge. And then finally, an inconsistency issue is it's incredible that the judge found that he was lacking display of some of the tenets of the Sikh faith by not wearing a turban and not wearing a knife in front of a federal immigration court. That seems preposterous.
Well, the knife is just one of five things, and the other things didn't look like he was adhering to the tenets of being a Sikh by his dress and his hair and so on.
Your Honor, you may be correct on that, but the other possibility is he was respecting the court that he was in front of by respecting how this country feels that people should be dressed in front of a courtroom, like I said, without a head covering.
But his hair was not long.
And he's a young man, Your Honor, too. Sometimes that's not easily developed by young men.
He didn't cut his hair for the proceeding. He's never had long hair in the United States. I mean, there are pictures in the record which have nothing to do with the hearing showing him with the short hair.
Your Honor, you may be correct there, and perhaps some of those issues were something that he has to address with his former attorney, but obviously that is not something for this court. That would be something for him to pursue in a Lozada-type claim. The only other point I would like to address at this point is one of the other reasons that the immigration judge had difficulties with his identity is she claimed that he was never fingerprinted, but it shows in the record that he was fingerprinted. He was just not subsequently fingerprinted again. But the claims that they didn't know who he was because he was never fingerprinted is actually just false. The record shows otherwise. And so statements like that by the immigration judge just contradict the evidence in hand. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coker. Mr. Fuller?
May it please the Court, Chris Fuller from the Office of Immigration Litigation, Department of Justice, representing the Office of the Attorney General and defending the Board of Immigration Appeals' final order of removal. Your Honor, you're correct. There is no case here. But let me do a bit of housekeeping on issues to make sure that we're clear. The asylum claim is barred for a finding by the immigration judge affirmed by the board that he'd failed to show by clear and convincing evidence that he filed his asylum claim within 1 year. And the precedent in this court and the congressional mandate is clear. The court has no jurisdiction to review that finding. It's factual. And therefore, the court has no jurisdiction to review the challenge to the denial of asylum. The court also has no jurisdiction to review the denial of voluntary departure, which was denied in lieu of the final order because it was denied as a matter of discretion. And 8 U.S.C. 1252A2B bars the court's review of that discretionary decision expressly. Finally, there's also a claim in the brief that immigration judge and the board did not address the exceptional circumstances exception to the one-year bar, but that was not raised to the BIA and hence was not exhausted, and by statute that's also barred from review, so the court has no jurisdiction over that. Ultimately, what is left is the withholding of removal claim and a torture claim, the claim for protection under the Convention Against Torture, which I refer to as cat protection. That's what's left. The immigration judge made two alternative findings as to those. One, made an adverse credibility finding and articulated cogent, specific reasons which have a nexus to the findings, satisfying this court's precedent. And second, an alternative finding that the on the merits, even if believable, on the merits of his claim based on his testimony alone, as the judge earlier acknowledged, there simply is no objective reasonable fear of future persecution in India. What I'd like to do is, there's a case that is of importance to the court and in this case. And it's called, and I apologize for the pronunciation, Pu V. Psicoda versus Gonzalez, 475 F. 3rd, 881. Judge Evans wrote for the majority. Judge Posner, you dissented in that case, but it's an important case because in that case, Judge Evans, described how aliens sometimes exaggerate or embellish their story for the purposes of their asylum claim. And Judge Posner, in dissent, talked about, well, it's a matter of proving by adverse credibility that the alien lied. Interesting enough, this case is not one where the alien embellished or exaggerated, but he lied. After swearing to tell the truth, he lied, and then he did it again, and he did it again. And the adverse credibility finding by the IJ and by the board must be sustained and the petition denied. There are four things I'd like to bring to the court's attention with regard to this alien's outright lies. First is with regard to his documents. He claimed at page 439 of the transcript, lines 4 and 5, and I quote directly, this is obviously the translator's language, but it's his. He said, quote, "I don't have a passport," end quote. Lines 16 and 18, he was questioned, "You don't have anything else to show who you are?" And he said, quote, "No, I don't," end quote. Then on page 440, he stated that the agent who arranged his travel had, quote, "all the papers. Somebody else was getting them," end quote. Apparently a reference that his papers, his identification papers, were going to be used for someone else for false entry into the country. Then at line 19 and 20, he was asked, well, it's been 4 years. This was in 2004. It's been 4 years since you're in the country. Couldn't you get identification papers? And he said, I quote, "I cannot get them from there because the police is still harassing us over there," end quote.
But what issues are these your 4 points germane to?
Adverse credibility.
Pardon?
Adverse credibility.
No, what issue? Asylum? Well,
no, goes to the remaining issues of withholding and CAT. This court has, in 8 separate decisions that I found quickly on Westlaw, found that adverse credibility...
Well, he has no well-founded fear of persecution. Right. He can't have any claim under the Convention Against Torture.
That's exactly the point, Your Honor, that ultimately, if he has no objective fear and his statements, in fact, were not credible, his claim must be denied on all asylum, withholding, and torture convention. So what's remaining is withholding of...
Your opponent is actually concerned with something quite different.
Yes.
He virtually concedes that his client has no well-founded fear of persecution. He's worried about the effect of this terrorist, the finding that he's a member of a terrorist organization, on his ability ever to come back to the United States. Do you want to address that?
He was not charged with that, and there's been no finding as to that. It was used in the adverse credibility finding to show that, in fact, he swore in his asylum application.
He says that there is a finding that he was a member of a terrorist organization and that it will prevent him from coming back.
Well, so I don't think that's accurate.
The first immigration judge made some comments about that.
Well, the first immigration judge said that because he was, then he's ineligible for all relief. That's accurate. It went to the board, and the board reversed and remanded. So that finding no longer exists. It was reversed by the board.
The second immigration judge's opinion, which suggests that she agrees with the finding of the first immigration judge that he belonged to that terrorist organization.
Well, he swore that he did.
Yes, but what is the significance of that footnote? Is that going to block him from coming back to the United States or what?
Well, I don't know the answer to that directly because it's going to depend on whether or not he's inadmissible at the time of reentry. But there is no finding and no charge that he, in fact, was a member of, nor that he has denied it in multiple circumstances. Okay.
And so if our opinion eventually in this case were to... say something to the effect that there is no evidence that we find to support any connection to terrorism here, that would, government wouldn't have any problem with that.
Well, there is evidence in the record that he is, because
well,
he said he was.
Either it's in or it isn't. And
yes,
you say it's not in the case, right?
But what I'm saying is that he swore that he was. Now, he denied that he was, but since ultimately you can choose, and I have no problem with the court saying that he denied it and refuted that, and we're satisfied with that refutation. It ultimately does not bear on this case. Okay? To be honest, ultimately, this
Sometimes
people deny,
you know, that's not all that unusual.
That's not all that unusual, to swear that he was and then to say that he wasn't. That ultimately just goes to credibility. And ultimately, if the court wants to put that aside and say that you're not convinced that ultimately he was or was not for the purposes of future entry, that is no concern here at this time.
Well, that's I think, what he wants, yeah.
Okay, and with that, we submit the matter to the court for resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Mr. Prokosh, do you have anything further?
Thank you, Your Honors. Just two quick points. One concerning whether or not this court's jurisdiction is barred for the review of the one-year rule. I just would like to draw the court's attention to a relatively recent decision by the Ninth Circuit, Ramadan v. Gonzalez. It was just last month, so I don't believe there is an official publication yet. And obviously it has no binding on this court, but they have found that for the one-year rule, if there is a mixed question of law or fact, they have found jurisdiction under the Real ID Act for reviewing that one-year bar. And then the second point is concerning the cogentness of the immigration judge's decision. Yes, it was definitely specific, but when the judge was actually factually incorrect again about fingerprinting and problems like that, I just don't see exactly how that can be cogent. And I'm sorry, one final point is on the voluntary departure. While yes, it is true that circuit courts do not have jurisdiction over the discretionary decision of a denial of voluntary departure, if it is based, in fact, on that ineligibility because of the terrorism finding, then that's not necessarily a discretionary decision, and I would submit that this court would have jurisdiction over that issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Prokosh and Mr. Fuller.